Okay, welcome everybody to the Disability Justice Panel Workshop at the 8th Annual F-Word Conference in the AMS Student Nest. We are currently broadcasting live on radio and streaming this online until the Q&A. Again, the discussion portion will not be broadcasted, so we're doing things a little bit differently. It's a bit of a wider audience, but most of them will be over the air, actually, so this will be interesting. Reed and Rob, you guys are also live with your mics. So I'm just going to pass this over. So this panel was developed as a part of a collaboration between the F-Word Conference and CITR's Accessibility Collective show, All Access Pass. The Accessibility Collective is dedicated to on-air representation of those with accessibility issues using media to discuss equity and inclusion. All Access Pass is currently airs every week, Thursdays from 2 to 3 p.m., and you'll be able to hear this once again on that program soon. The panel will also be made available on All Access Pass's podcast page, which you can reach at citr.ca. Without further ado, I'd like to introduce our moderator, Dr. Litsa. She's a sessional instructor at the G.R. Shea Institute at UBC, where she teaches film and popular culture with a special emphasis on resistance and decolonizing movements. Both her teaching interests and her activist work focus on Indigenous and Black liberation movements, Muslim woman movements, anti-capitalist struggles, migrant justice struggles, post-civilization, environmental grassroots activism, and animal rights feminism.
Thank you, Desi. Hi everyone. I first want to acknowledge that we are on unceded and sovereign Indigenous Coast Salish territories, particularly Musqueam land. And again, remind you that this is to remind us that being at this university, doing research, studying, writing, we all benefit from the fact that this is an occupied territory. And we are complicit in settler colonialism. I want to introduce our presenters today. I'm not sure what's the order. Are we? Okay. We first have Lynn St. Marie. They are an Afro-Goth poet, a multimedia artist, activist, educator of the Jamaican diaspora with a ancestral roots indigenous to Africa and the British Isles. A disabled, chronically ill, non-binary, gender-fluid person, they currently reside in the Greater Toronto Area. They identify within queer and trans, femme, boy, gender non-conforming, creep and spoony communities, as well as a survivor of abuse and intergenerational trauma. And they will be speaking to us through Skype. Lynn, you can hear us, right?
Yeah, I can hear you. Can you hear me?
We can hear you perfectly.
Okay, wonderful.
Then we have Rob Sleet. In addition to his work with the CNIB, Rob is founding member, president, and chair of Access for Sight Impaired Consumers and immediate past president of Compact. In 2007, Rob was appointed to the role of chair of the South Coast British Columbia Transportation Authority's Advisory Committee, an active committee which assists Metro Vancouver's Public Transit Authority on accessible policies and service delivery. And as a member of BASICS, Blind and Sight Impaired Consumers, Rob is also providing disability awareness seminars to public transit operators in the Metro Vancouver area. He has recently been elected as chair for Barrier Free BC, a nonpartisan grassroots movement calling on the BC legislature to enact a Strong and Effective British Columbians with Disabilities Act. His community involvement was recognized by the BC Achievement Foundation when Rob was selected as one of BC's 2008 Community Achievement Award recipients. He was nominated for the Community Leader, BC and the North Regional Prime Minister's Award for years of outstanding community service. And in 2012, he was presented with Queen Elizabeth's Diamond Jubilee Medal in recognition of his community service. Please join me in welcoming Rob. The next presenter is Reed Pointer, Chair, Communications Subcommittee, Barrier Free BC. In his retirement from TELUS in 2005, Reed has volunteered with NIB as a peer counseling support person and as chair of CNIB's Lower Mainland, South Coast and Fraser Valley Regional Advisory Board. He has also worked as a volunteer with the Nordic Racers Paranordic Cross Country Ski Club and the Langley's Children's Society. Reed is a member at large on the Access for Sight Impaired Consumers Board in Vancouver. He's currently very active with the Barrier Free BC campaign to lobby for the enactment of disability accessibility legislation in the province of British Columbia. In addition to his volunteering, Reed spends his time performing, quote unquote, other duties as assigned by his wife, Avon, helping to manage and keep the books for his wife's medical office, gardening, reading, learning piano, cross-country skiing, chasing his wife around the countryside on the back of their tandem bike, working around their 2.5-acre property in Langley, along with his volunteering, keeps him busy enough. He also loves to visit his three adult children and his three grandchildren. Please welcome Reed Pointer. And Lynx, are you ready?
Yeah, I'm ready.
Yeah. So we start with Lynx.
How much time do I have, by the way?
Sorry?
How much time do I have to present?
I would say about 15 minutes.
15 minutes? Okay, great. So good afternoon, everyone. I want to thank the organizers of the F-Word Conference for having me here today. So again, my name is Lynx. I go by the moniker Lynx St. Marie, Afro-Goth Poet. I am a multimedia artist, activist, educator, agitator, instigator. My pronouns are they and them, and I identify as a disabled, chronically ill person. And I came to disability justice a few years ago after battling many years of internalized ableism and ableism inside of spaces that were supposed to be, you know, supposedly good for my body. And it's interesting talking about disability justice. Like I'm also like post-secondary educated, and I'm often asked to lecture at universities and colleges to talk about disability justice and talk about the principles of disability justice. And I feel like it's very interesting talking about these things in these settings because traditionally, historically, you know, and currently for many of us, you know, who are disabled, these particular spaces are very unsafe, particularly for those of us who are disabled, mad, chronically ill, but who are also Black, Indigenous, people of color. But I think that there is a hunger within these institutions to talk about ableism and the many ways that it mutates and changes faces in the academic industrial complex. So, you know, that's kind of what I've been doing for the last little while, disability justice lecturing and activism, as well as art. I am very much a student of the disability justice principles created by Sins Invalid, As someone whose lived reality really resonates with the notion of disability justice as a framework, as an intersectional framework for everything that we do, I'm really inspired and, you know, emotionally attached and shaken by the words of disability justice activists and artists, you know, disabled BIPOC artists and activists, many of whom are, you know, my friends and, you know, Black and disabled people who are taking care of themselves outside of systems that don't see their bodies as whole and real and valuable and beautiful. I was just on a panel, you know, a few minutes ago speaking about violence against Black bodies. And one of the things I really wanted to convey in that presentation was that activism is just white supremacy if you're not really doing the work. Right? Activism is just ableism if you're not really doing the work. If you're not really doing the work of dismantling and building and seeking relationships with people and being introspective and mindful, we're just perpetuating these systems over and over again and being complicit in these systems over and over again. And I feel like disability justice is a wonderful framework to really, you know, ground us and to take a really intersectional approach at what disability in everybody can look like. So I identify with the word spoonie. Has anyone ever heard of this term, spoonie, in the audience? One person, maybe? Okay, well, the term spoonie, it comes out of spoon theory, which was created by a blogger online who wanted to talk about how having an autoimmune disease affected her day-to-day living. And it's basically, talks about like energy and capacity when dealing with chronic illness. And with that being said, you know, someone who's chronically ill is someone who identifies as a spoonie. Disability in my body is fluid. You know, I would argue that disability isn't a static experience for many of us. You know, no body experiences health in a static way. You know, even if you're non-disabled, if you have a cold, you know, you have a cold and you don't, your body experiences a stressful situation, you get nervous, your body reacts, your body relaxes, you know, like no body experiences health and disability in one way for the rest of their life. It often changes. And I feel like our needs change as well. One of the things I really want to do and work towards in the future is working more with medical professionals around chronic illness. You know, many health professionals are ignorant of what chronic illness can look like in a body with multiple intersections, or, you know, a racialized body. And because these needs change, I feel like medical care professionals need to be acknowledged that not all bodies fit into the biomedical model as one would neatly think. So that, you know, that's kind of some work that I would want to do in the future. But yeah, so I come from, you know, a family of chronically ill people. My mother is disabled and chronically ill, but, you know, don't tell her that. You know, she's very good at passing as non-disabled. No shame or blame to her. You know, this ableist, capitalist, racist myth is very important in Black communities, particularly those of us who are women and femmes. You know, we need to be seen as having nothing wrong with us because of, you know, white supremacy and anti-Blackness. And this idea that, like, Black people are inherently strong, or, you know, we are or should feel less pain or are resilient in all these ways. And so, you know, I was socialized from a very young age that I needed to be strong. And so years later, when I started showing signs of chronic illness that I could no longer hide, I held a lot of guilt and shame around that and was reluctant to seek any sort of help or support. And that guilt and shame was further aggravated by the ways, you know, medical professionals, quote unquote professionals, would treat me. And I think that for a long time, I tried my very best not to go to hospitals or doctors. And that is a very common experience for those of us who are racialized, who are Black, Indigenous, who are queer and trans, and who are disabled, we often find ways to deal and find ways to cope. And for some of us, this works out. For others, not so much. But I find that those of us with unknown chronic illnesses, you know, we are pushed out of these systems because people don't know how to place us. And that is a problem. It's a problem that disability and illness are seen as anomalies. They're seen as, you know, something only certain people can get or certain people have. And I also find that I know very few people who are Black and don't have some sort of, you know, chronic illness or mental health issue as well, right? And that speaks to that speaks to a lot of things that are going on in our society. And so as an activist, because these systems have failed me in a number of ways, I really started to delve into healing outside of these systems. I really wanted to, you know, started to learn about disability justice and healing justice. And these movements center disabled, queer, and trans, Black, Indigenous people of color, and centers our Indigenous ways of knowing. It centers self-determination and autonomy and interdependence and sustainability. And I think that when we're talking about disability justice, if we aren't talking about these communities, then we're erasing that narrative, we're erasing that knowledge. And yeah, I think that we were really craving disability justice as a society because the ways that we focus on disability, the ways that we focus on our bodies under these ableist capitalist notions are not sustainable. Like even in our activist movements, I feel like a lot of us are dealing with a lot of burnouts. Because we're focusing on the work and that the work should heal us as opposed to, you know, implementing the healing into our work, right? And, you know, a lot of other narratives around, you know, activism and disability, I feel like are just perpetuating the same, like, mainstream narratives that we experience every day. And yeah, I think that a lot of the times ableism is disguised as care when it really isn't. And I think that these movements were really helpful in that they helped me reclaim my body as a body that has been colonized and that has been traumatized and touched without consent and marginalized and that doesn't fit in a binary and generally feels unloved through the way society treats it and supposedly cares for it. And I do a lot of work online and off, emotional labor, workshops, you know, with like these communities that I have so much love and heart for, because we are experiencing the similar experiences of oppression and ableism. And also a lot of my art speaks to my experiences finding care and finding my way home back to my body. And again, recognizing that, you know, disabled bodies are not an anomaly. And also that many of us become disabled, you know, whether it's by being born, whether it's, you know, by living, because of trauma, because of violence and oppression. And that's something a lot of us aren't speaking about in our movements, that police brutality, you know, has disabling impacts on our bodies as Black people. And so, yeah, so I think I'm just going to wrap up and say this, that there is an urgency for all of us, whether we're activists, whether we're healthcare professionals, whether we're artists, you know, whoever, to start seeing people, you know, seeing disabled people as their whole authentic selves. And really helping to cultivate cultures of care and not cultures of shame and blame. And medical care professionals have so much power because of cultural symbolism and colonial constructs of care, so much power. But all of us have the capacity to be healers in our own right. but only if we're working together to support each other's autonomy, only if we're working together to remember our ancestors, to never forget our historical and social context and relationship to this land, only if we're building relationships with each other. And, you know, like I don't necessarily believe in allyship. I think that it's about relationships. I think allyship and the concept of allies is really divorced from like the communities that we're trying to like support. I think relationships and solidarity and love come from having really hard conversations and not, you know, giving yourself this title or expecting someone else to give it to you. But yeah, that's a whole nother thing. And yeah, I think that also, as I mentioned before, you know, paying attention to movements in queer, disabled, BIPOC communities around healing and around wholeness and supporting their importance, because BIPOC are always on the front lines of these movements. And I think that our work and our art is often erased around narratives of disability when we've been here this whole time. And for all of us to use all of this collective knowledge as disabled folks and as non-disabled folks to strive towards the liberation of all of us, because, you know, I believe and many of us believe that I can only be saved if you're saved. I can only be liberated if you're liberated. And I think that's like a really, like, I think that that's the point that I'm going to leave my presentation on, that collective liberation is something that we should all be working towards, whether we're disabled or not. So thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Lynx, for the powerful words. We're moving on with the next presenter, Rob Slit.
Good afternoon, and thank you very much. On behalf of my co-presenter and colleague, we'd like to extend our deepest appreciation to the F-Word Conference, to Desi and her team for having us come out and speak with you this afternoon. My name is Rob Slith. I'm the chair of Barrier Free BC. Barrier Free BC is a nonpartisan grassroots movement calling on the British Columbia legislature to enact a strong, effective, and enforceable disability legislation in the province of British Columbia. Legislation that will serve to remove barriers and prevent the creation of new barriers for people with disabilities, and it will also have a very positive impact on all British Columbians at some point in their lives. To illustrate this point, let me just pause for a moment and ask, just by maybe a short round of applause, how many people in this room currently do not have a disability and are guaranteed never to get one? I asked that question at my last presentation. The room burst out with applause, and I thought, geez, I want that magic pill. But on a serious note, the legislation that we are asking the government to bring into effect will help to remove these barriers and, most importantly, prevent the creation of new barriers. And we can get into a few examples in just a moment. There are approximately 600,000 British Columbians currently living with a disability in this province, and we face too many unfair accessibility barriers. Barriers in which the province, with proper legislation, could help to remove those barriers. These barriers exist in areas such as public transit, education, access to public parks and provincial parks, to the healthcare system, library services. We see all kinds of barriers to retail shops, restaurants, recreation facilities, entertainment venues, and especially the workplace, which prevents a number of people with disabilities from gaining gainful employment. The other type of legislation that we are looking for would also include strong enforcement. And we'll get into some of that when we talk about the principles behind the legislation that we're asking for at the present time. The Federal Ministry of Sport and Persons with Disabilities just recently concluded cross-Canada consultations as she works to develop a Canadians with Disabilities Act, which is anticipated to be introduced sometime in late 2017 or the mid 2018. We've asked the minister in our presentations to her to ensure that this disability legislation is strong, it's enforceable, and that it sets the bar at a very, very high standard. One of the other things that we've asked the minister to bring into her proposed legislation is the endorsement of the various protocols under the United Nations Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities. Canada subscribed to the United Nations Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities back in March of 2010, but the one thing they didn't do was subscribe to the protocols, and we feel that's essential in bringing in any federal legislation. Here in this province, we are behind four other provinces right at the moment. Ontario introduced disability legislation back in 2005, Manitoba followed in 2013, and Nova Scotia just proclaimed had the third reading of their accessibility legislation on Thursday this past week. Quebec also has their disability legislation well entrenched into their provincial legislation. So we're well behind four of the other provinces, and we feel it's time for British Columbia now to step up and bring in really what probably would be better defined as accessibility and inclusion legislation in this province. In June of 2014, the provincial government introduced an initiative entitled Accessibility 2024, which was designed to make British Columbia the most progressive province for persons with disabilities in all of Canada. It's a nice term, it sounds good, but what does it mean? What we have found over the last couple of years is that Accessibility 2024 is really nothing more than a political statement. It is neither mandated or legislated. And so for businesses and organizations to abide by what that initiative is trying to do is strictly voluntary. We need strong, effective, and enforceable legislation to bring things into line. At the current time, people with disabilities, their only recourse in the event that they face some sort of discrimination or barrier is to fight those barriers one company at a time, one barrier at a time, on an individual basis. And we've discovered cases where individuals with the same type of disability are fighting the same barrier with a different company over and over again. So what I'm going to do is just turn it over to my colleague for just a moment. I'm going to ask him to speak and give you a few examples about some of the human rights barriers that we have been facing. Reid?
Right, thank you, Rob. And just in starting with that, in addition to what Rob has said, I wanted to emphasize that with the adoption of the United Nations Protocol and with Canada signing on to it, giving people who need access to things that they need access to isn't just a nice thing to do. It's now a human right. The province is obligated under the terms of the United Nations Agreement to make sure that these barriers disappear. Now, as Rob said, the only recourse we have is if we have what we consider to be a human rights issue is to go to the BC Human Rights Tribunal. The way the BC Human Rights Tribunal works is they say, okay, you have lodged a complaint, you and the organization that you're complaining about will go into mediation and see if you can resolve your issues. If you can't resolve your issues, then the Human Rights Tribunal will have a hearing. Even going through the mediation process can be very expensive. One example that I wanted to use, and it's a good example as to why Accessibility 2024 isn't worth very much. Access for Sight Impaired Consumers a couple of years ago took Walmart to the BC Human Rights Tribunal because Walmart in Canada would not provide prescription labeling information to the visually impaired. People who are sighted go into the drugstore, they come back with three or four bottles of prescription medication, and they're all labeled. And you all know what is on the label. A visually impaired person goes and gets his medication and has absolutely no documentation. That's pretty scary. So there is technology available, but I won't talk about the technology that's available. But there is technology available. It's relatively inexpensive, but Walmart wouldn't do it, even though Walmarts all across the United States have done it and have been doing it for some years. So they went to mediation, and 2 years and approximately $25,000 for the complainant later, an agreement was struck. The agreement was not really that great. What they've agreed to do is provide the labeling within a 48-hour time frame. If you're a sighted person, you can get the labeling right away. So it's not really an accessible solution, but it's better than it was. So given that it went to mediation, the other thing that the Human Rights Tribunal does is the only information that they publish is the information having to do with actual hearings. So anything that was resolved by mediation isn't published and isn't available for public access. So then somebody else comes along and they may have a problem with Shoppers Drug Mart. Unless they were able to read it in the newspaper or somewhere else, they had no idea that somebody had the same complaint with Walmart. So they have to start all over again, and that's in fact what happened. A second complaint having to do with Shoppers Drug Mart went forth. It was like a brand new human rights complaint to the Human Rights Tribunal. There was no reference to the first one. And so the process went through all over again. And another $25,000 later, and approximately 2 years later, there was an agreement struck with Shoppers Drug Mart. And it was about the same as what happened with Walmart. Now, when these things come to resolution, there is a financial settlement involved, and that part we're not allowed to talk about because there's a confidentiality agreement in place, which for me is problematic because, again, if somebody wants to know about what these kinds of claims cost, there's no real way of finding out unless it's published. Another example I'll give you is a year and a half ago, and this will shock all of you, I'm sure, a hard of hearing individual had to take the Ministry of Social Development and Social Innovation to the BC's Human Rights Tribunal because they wouldn't accommodate his needs as a deaf person. And as a result of going to mediation, and I'm sure it was a costly process, again, it took about a year and a half, the Ministry of Human Resources and, I mean, Human, what are they called? Social Development, Social Innovation have changed the policy. Now, nobody knows about that. When I was doing some research, I happened to find it in the newspaper. I did a media search for Human Rights Tribunal complaints, and I found it in the newspaper. There's no reference to it at the Human Rights Tribunal website. So it's flawed. So given that this is the only remedy that we have, it isn't really a remedy. There aren't very many persons with disabilities who, number one, have the wherewithal or the financial ability, even if they are going to get some of their money back in the long run, to do a complaint. So they're just stuck with suffering with whatever the barrier is. Just as a final note, when I was doing my research, I went to the BC Human Rights Tribunal website and I wanted to find some numbers on how many complaints they've dealt with over the last year having to do with disabilities. So I went to their website and I downloaded their annual general report for 2015-2016, and it wasn't accessible to the visually impaired. This is the Human Rights Tribunal, the guys that are supposed to be dealing with it. Now, as a result of me making a phone call, they said that they would go through and make sure that they are all accessible. I don't know if they've done it yet, but you see, it's everywhere. And I mean, we were actually talking about how does one take the BC Human Rights Tribunal to the BC Human Rights Tribunal. It gets to be problematic, right? So it's not a very good solution. So back to Rob.
Okay, thank you, Reid.
Just quickly, Lynx needs to sign off. So we're just going to say bye to Lynx. Thank you, Lynx, for coming in for not one but two panels and being an amazing speaker. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Lynx, so much.
Thank you so much for having me. Yeah, take care, everyone.
Okay, thank you.
Bye.
Can I continue? Okay. Okay, and just one last thing on Reid's summary of our only recourse being the Human Rights Tribunal. The one thing also to recognize is the BC Human Rights Tribunal is reactive as opposed to proactive. Any of the rulings or any of the mediated settlements that we come out with, if a respondent chooses not to abide by the mediation or the ruling, the Human Rights Tribunal has no authority to enforce it. In other words, the respondent could basically say, forget it, yes, I agreed to this, but I'm not going to abide by it. We would then have the expense of taking them to the BC Supreme Court to try and get some of the court support in terms of enforcing the ruling. So what we've done is we've come out with 13 principles upon which we think a British Columbians with Disabilities Act should be based. I won't go through all of them in the interest of time. I'll just touch on a couple. But the primary ones are that the Act would set a timeline. In other words, the goal of the Act would be to make British Columbia accessible to all persons with disabilities within a certain time frame, and that time frame would begin the minute the legislation was proclaimed. The Act would apply to all, and what we mean by that is that everybody who is affected by a disability, whether that disability be permanent or episodic, whether it be visible to others or invisible to other people, whether it be physical, sensory, communication related, cognitive, or mental health related, we would ask that the legislation cover all people with disabilities. There are several other principles that we've got engaged in there. We have given copies to Desi as a handout for you as you leave the room. We'll make sure you have copies of those principles. The one that we particularly like is the one that says no public money will be used to create or perpetuate barriers for people with disabilities. And many of you would be familiar with the recent barrier that was created by TransLink when they put in the fare gates. They neglected to listen to the disabled communities, and they put in fare gates that were not accessible to people who had fine motor skill problems. And so we had people using mobility aids that didn't have the ability to tap into the fare gates as they entered the SkyTrain or Canada Line stations. And right then and there was a barrier that was preventing people from accessing public transit. So we've got that particular principle in place. Like I say, there's 13 principles upon which we feel the legislation should be based, and we'll be sure to give you all copies of that before you leave. As I close off today, there is one request that I would like to make of all of you. We would very much appreciate having the support of every single person in this room. And as I started off earlier with the beginning of my presentation, a British Columbians with Disabilities Act will not only impact and benefit people who have disabilities today, but it is very likely that at some point in your life, you will acquire a disability. Now, what I mean by that, and that's not to scare everybody in the room, but all you need to do is look at your grandparents or members of your family who have aged. Disabilities affect everybody at some point in their life. In some cases, it's permanent. In some cases, it's episodic. In other cases, it's minor. In other cases, it can be life-changing. So if we can get this legislation in place, we think it will benefit absolutely every British Columbian. What we would like to ask of you this afternoon is to go onto our website, which is at barrierfreebc.org, all one word, barrierfreebc.org. There is a link there to add your voice. And if you add your voice to our campaign, we're not going to ask you for money. We're not going to ask you for donations. We're simply going to ask you to add your voice to let the government know that you believe in the 13 principles that we've put forth, and they're on our website, by the way, and that you would like to see the government enact disability legislation in this province. The other thing I would like to ask you for is if any of you are interested in assisting us with our social media channels, with redesigning our website or updating our website, or we also have a need for some volunteers in the area of communications. If any of you are interested in assisting us in that area, or your colleagues or friends might be interested in helping us and doing some volunteer work, we would very much appreciate your help. And you can reach us, or you can reach Reed through our website. Our email address is listed on there. So Desi, on that note, I'll close off because I know you're running a little bit behind here. And if you wanted to open the floor for questions, we're happy to take them.
Okay, for those of you over the air, thank you for tuning in to the Disability Justice Panel Workshop at the 8th Annual F-Word Conference.